thought leader and influencer. This is Luba Mayegiso and the Africa Report.
Time is 8:36. I'm Howard Feldman. Good morning, Luba Mayegiso. Good morning to you. Before we talk about anything political, social or otherwise, how is your family? I believe you've been visited by the dreaded Rona.
Drumbeat of your song reminded me of Depeche Mode's People Are People. But anyway, I won't go there. Yeah, Corona, it did visit, Howard. It's interesting because I think there are a lot of wonderful theories on how to deal with it, but the reality is that it's a lot more complex, than you imagine. Because with us, there was first a debate as to who was patient zero, because we've got a 22-year-old son, and like any good 22-year-old, he parties quite hard, never tells us where he's going. So I think we started picking up that this chap is, you know, kind of sneezing and coughing and everything. Mm-hmm. And of course he claims he's perfectly fine. So somehow, I think it was last week on Monday, you know, my wife hadn't felt very well over the weekend, just slept most of it. So I said, well, let's go and have ourselves tested. And in Cape Town, you've got a clinic at, Groteski, and it's, we walked in, I think there were two people, and it's fairly quick. You get the results same day. And the first hurdle was, she's a housewife. And they said, no, we can't test you. You have to be employed. And I was like, wow, really?
What? Oh my word. I'm actually nervous for what happened next.
So she was quite angry, and then somebody else said, no, stick around, we'll test you. And then we both tested. It was quite amusing because I had my mask on. And so she says to me, oh, really? Are you going to do this to me? Do you think I'm infectious? We hadn't got the results. And I said, well, it's prudence, but it didn't go down well. So I think we tested in the morning at about 9. And then in the afternoon, you know, they text you. So I got a text saying, you know, your test results are negative. And she got a text saying, your test results are ready. And she said, why aren't they giving me my results? And I said, well, we have to call. So hers came back positive. And then the next day, so we kind of moved the rest of the family then, who the kids hadn't tested. So we figured that our 22-year-old was patient zero. So we let him and mommy at home and moved everybody else out. And then we took the rest for a test. And so the girls are aged 26 and 16, and then there was Emmy, who's 9.
Right.
The 23-year-old was defiant. He was saying, nope, I'm fine. You guys can go test. And they were happy to test. But first you sit there and they say, you don't have the symptoms. And you're saying, but somebody's tested positive. They said, but you don't have the symptoms. And I'm like, if we're in the same house, are you really going to pull this on me? So eventually they were willing to test the 22-year-old. Then they said, no, the other one is 16, we won't test. I said, she's in the middle of exams, so I need clarity, you know. I need the test to know what school I don't.
Yeah.
I had quite a long argument, and eventually they agreed. So they tested both girls. Then they said, Emmy, who's 9, they're not testing him. They just refused flat and said, well, go to Red Cross. Went to Red Cross, and Red Cross screamed at me and said, how do you even bring him here? Who told you to bring him to us? I said, well, what this kid told me to bring him to you. And they said, no, go to a clinic. Then eventually I thought, find a private lab. So everybody else then tested negative. But the challenge, Howard, now is, what do you do? Because you're sitting in the middle of exams. So you've got a grade 10 is writing exams, and the school is saying, well, keep her at home for the next 10 days. And I'm like, when do we start counting the 10 days from when one person tested positive? Because when you test positive, it's been in your system for 5 to 7 days, they say. So I said, then what do we do? You know, when do we start counting? And so both school-going kids are tested negative. But, you know, the one school said, fantastic, she can come back. And I'm like, this is writing exams. And so in the end, we've had to keep both of them now. Emmy, who turns 10 today, will be back. He'll be back, I think, from Friday. But his school said, well, keep him and bring him on Monday. But the challenge is, he's doing assessments in grade 4, and the marks, the final day for submitting the marks to the department is Monday, and that's the day he gets back. And he's written one assessment.
Surely, you know, it sounds like this is brand new to the Western Cape, this whole thing. Like it's just happened. It's not like we haven't been dealing with this for 8 months. It sounds like your treatment around this has really been terrible, and the lack of clarity has been terrible.
It is, because you're asking yourself, when do I count? Because I'm saying, you know what, now if I take my son, for instance, I say, now he eventually went, the 22-year-old, and his test came back positive last Friday, but we knew he was sick before everybody. So, you know, he hadn't been quarantining initially because he never knew. So now I'm asking, when does he quarantine from? Because he was the last to test, but he was the first to get ill. So we can't start counting 10 days from Friday. And it becomes very murky. So there's no absolute clarity. And it's most frustrating, you know. It's easier for people who are working. But with the kids, we now have the 9-year-old who effectively can write his assessments at home, but then will get a mark and then a comment not assessed or something like that. So he can write and hand it in and they'll mark it. But it won't be a true assessment. And the grade 10... they're saying, well, it won't be an average mark, but wherever you used to come, let's say you're doing English and you used to come sixth out of the class, they'll mark the exams and then you will then be given whatever the sixth position is. So it's a lottery. Hmm. And Shalom is the one who was stressed about the corona early on in the year. She hasn't got it, but it's still managed to catch up with her during the exams. So it's been very interesting. It's been very interesting. I mean, you know, not much medication. It's vitamin this and this and this and the other, and trying to figure out how, you know, how you keep a family split and how you get food to the other ones. So you'd have to order Uber Eats and, you know, come and pick up the food and put it in the door and then they can grab the food. And it's also a lot of tension because those who have tested positive feel like you're ostracizing them, you know, because you're walking around with a mask and everything else. So it can test, you know, patients and nerves to quite a great degree, I can tell you that. Yeah.
So just health-wise, how's everybody doing? How bad has it been?
You know, I think Lady was bad in the sense that her body was sore. Now, the puzzling one was Cassie, where her body was quite sore, you know, breathing, headaches, and everything. Absolutely terrible. But she's tested negative twice. And so you scratch your head and you're trying to figure out. So I think an option might be to do an antibody because, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I'm saying to Cassie, because we've been told that the symptoms will last for months. So your difficulty in breathing and headaches can last well beyond, you know, your recovery of 10 days. So what if then the question I'm asking is you may have had corona 2 months ago, but a mild version that, you know, put you to bed, but you still got the lingering symptoms because she has the symptoms. I mean, she tested, I think, yesterday and she tested last week, Monday, and both came out negative.
Really not easy times at all. And just wish you from us and all of our listeners a refuah shlema, only quick recovery for everybody in the family. And may just they return to full health as speedily as possible. Moving on to some of the conversations we wanted to have. It's certainly been a big week around crime in South Africa. The government, and I mentioned this to Howard Saxton earlier, finding a lot of outrage for the shepherds, not so much for Ace, really. Give us your thoughts around this.
Yes, it has been strange. I mean, Ace has received tremendous support, and the shepherds have been. I got a call from an MP yesterday asking me about shepherds' flight, and I was a bit puzzled because I didn't know what I had to do with it. And he was like, "What's your position? Should we ask the minister?" And I said, "Have you read the statements from the Malawian government?" He says, "No, send them to me." And it's interesting because there's a lot of outrage around shepherd, and I think in many ways churches, when they step out of line, tend to get the brunt of government. They are easy targets, I think, in many ways, because the ACE issue has a lot of politics, and a lot of people will tiptoe around it. I think for me, what I found interesting was the support he had. It almost reminded me of the Zuma issue when, you know, Zuma was being accused of many things with the arms deal. There were people who stood by him and who were almost anticipating what might happen. And you kind of wonder, some of the support, I mean, you saw people like Tony Yengeni and lots of people arriving at Bloemfontein to support him. And you wonder, are these people kind of hedging their bets and saying, this guy's a survivor, he might be around in a couple of years' time, and therefore it might pay me to be in his good books. But certainly, I think it's very selective of government. But I think more than anything, there is deep embarrassment in the Bushiri case, because everything pointed to that he would be a flight risk. I mean, he went on social media posting a Maserati SUV as a gift for his daughter about a year ago. And even before he went for the bail hearing, there were news reports that that car had already left the country with the Bentley. Now, how he got them out, I don't know. So I think there's an embarrassment that internationally our borders have again been shown to be very porous. You know, somebody becomes a fugitive and leaves, and we have no trace of them. But Howard, let's be honest. I mean, if we look at how many people enter our country illegally, millions. So for me, I was not surprised that he fled. It wasn't difficult. I think the interesting part was the fact that they suspected the president, because even though government is not saying so, the fact that they kept searching a presidential jet, you know, going inside twice at Waterkloof and Owar Tambo, meant that they thought he could have been spirited away by the Malawian government. What that does now for our relationship with Malawi is going to be very interesting. So I think more it was the public humiliation on the other side, whereas if it's in-house, it's politics, and the politics are handled very differently. There doesn't seem to be as great remorse in dealing with your own blunders as it is somebody who's outside, who's now, you know, the international media, I think, follows the ACE issue, but it's probably not as fascinating to the rest of Africa, but the Bushiri one will be of more newsworthy to the rest of Africa and to the general populace, not necessarily countries.
Does it reflect an inability of the ANC? I mean, we've spoken about this before, to look inward, because the reaction around ACE, it's so measured and so balanced, yet you see this thing around the Bushiris. And I'm not saying, obviously, that they're not criminals and they don't need to be held accountable and that they should be flitting out the country after they've stolen from people. But I just find the level of reaction to be very telling.
Well, it's a welcome relief, because you've got somebody, an offender who's outside the party that you can focus on, that you can hopefully draw public outrage to. Because remember, the challenge you have with ACE is that they're factions. ACE has got a very strong grouping behind him. The president's got another group. So you've got two groups that are vying and competing. So I think common sense then for anybody inside the party will be like, let me tiptoe. I know, for instance, if you take the tender issue, the PPEs, many people that I would speak to would say, you know what? You would get in a certain province two factions both getting tenders, and the one faction would run to the media. So it almost becomes exposing the other side is not necessarily driven by a moral conscience, but rather to fight an internal battle. And so that what makes the party battles a little bit more complicated to look at, because, you know, are you pursuing ACE genuinely because you think he's corrupt? I mean, also like Zuma, he's come out saying that I can name people, I can name everybody, I know what everybody's done.
But that's from the playbook. You know, they seem to have one playbook within the ANC leadership. Their first thing they do is demand that they have their day in court, even though they're going to spend their whole lives avoiding it. Then they're going to say, we are going to expose everybody else. Thirdly, they've got to go for conspiracy theories. It's really simply just a character assassination and potentially even a third force. This is what, and then when all else fails, we got to go the poison route. Somebody's trying to poison them.
But remember, it's worked reasonably well. I mean, if you look at how long the former president stayed out of actually having a court date, I mean, it's been remarkably well. It's over 10 years. So if you were ACE, you'd be emboldened to think they can go down the same avenue, because it's managed to keep, you know, Zuma out of getting in front of any judge for a period of time. And so I think my guess, Howard, is that there's probably some truth in a claim that, you know, I think it's unlikely that anybody would kind of dip his fingers in a cookie jar to that extent and not have shared it with other people. So I think to a degree there are other people that are involved that he knows who would be uncomfortable and be very worried about the threat. There are a lot more who are innocent. But remember again, the question comes back to the issue is, can you really afford to, as the ANC, to really wash your dirty laundry in public and keep the party intact? And I think that what it comes down to is that you kind of tiptoe. I mean, the president has not gone out and come out publicly against anybody perceived of being involved in corruption. Mm. He's tried to gently nudge, you know, the police and security cluster to do their work while sitting back and then saying, I'm not driving this, but it's a natural consequence of what's playing out. The question, for instance, that some people asked was, when some people were implicated in the Free State asbestos trial, they were quick to issue subpoenas, but we have a health minister where there were claims that money was paid supposedly to the ANC, but with his name as a reference. And he's denied it, and evidently that's all there seems to be to it, and nothing further. So it's very difficult, because some of the people that might be fingered are sitting in his camp. I'm not absolving them and saying nothing should be done, but I'm thinking it's a very interesting battle. It's almost like a game of chess.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
it really is.
With the many, that's at play.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's the South African population who are losing the game. Luba Maki, so I think that's where we do have to leave it. It is 8:53. Thank you, as always, and again, wishing your family a speedy recovery, a refuah shlema from us all.